Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time now is 5:31 p.m. on Thursday, January 26, 2017. Present today, we have Representative Ortiz, Representative Kawasaki, Vice Chair Guerra, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, Representative Gren, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Thompson, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And in the audience, I see that we have Representative Millett and the sponsor of the bill, Representative Josephson. Do we have any other representatives in the room? Looks like we don't. Okay, an excuse today is Representative Wilson. She had a previously scheduled meeting concerning the Office of Children's Services, a very important event she has going on, so she's been excused. Before we start, please mute your cell phones. We've been also joined by Representative Pruitt. And today the plan is to introduce the bill and take questions from the committee concerning House Bill 23, which is insurance for dependents of deceased police and firefighters, by Representative Josephson. We will then put his bill aside. We'll be taking public testimony on this bill on Wednesday, February 1, at a regularly scheduled meeting, and then public testimony for HB 23 will be following another finance presentation on that day. I also ask members to get amendments to Jane Pearson, my staffer, in my office by 5 p.m. on Friday, February 3. And we do have a proposed committee substitute for HB 23. Co-Chair Seaton, may I have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the committee adopt as its work draft CS for HB 23, Finance 30LS0258/0, dated January 26, 2017.
Great. Thank you. Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, this version is adopted as the committee's work draft for House Bill 23. Now I would like the bill sponsor, Representative Josephson, and his aide, Lisa Weisler, to come to the table and present House Bill 23 to the committee. I also ask that the sponsor or his aide go through the sectional summary for this bill. And please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead and proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Andy Josephson. I represent House District 17 in Anchorage. With me is my chief of staff. Many of you might recognize Lisa Weisler. We appreciate the opportunity to present this bill to you today. I'm not going to be too terribly long. What I would propose is that I provide a little bit of background for the members. Many of them will recall the history. And then I have a statement I'd like to read into the record, if I may.
Sure.
So the background, as Representative Kopp said so eloquently yesterday in a special order, could be traced back, obviously, to the territorial days and even before that, in that, as Representative Kopp said, there have been, I think he said, 70 officers of one variety or another who've lost their lives serving the public. More recently, what prompted recent legislative action was the tragic death of Gabe Rich and Scott Johnson in Tananaw, followed very recently by the death of Officer Alan Brandt. And everyone is familiar with those facts. In terms of the legislative history, Governor Parnell, after the death of the troopers in Tananaw, made an administrative fix that was the right thing to do. I filed House Bill 3, which sort of tracked Governor Parnell's efforts. My colleague, Representative Millett, filed House Bill 66, which became the vehicle that ultimately passed in mid-June, 34-0. There were a total of 10 committee hearings, actually 9. This is the 10th. The last committee meeting of any kind, not surprisingly, occurred here. It was about a 3.5-hour meeting on House Bill 4002, which, when Representative Millett's bill was withdrawn, became the vehicle. The governor introduced that in, I think, one of the special sessions, I think the fourth. And that became the vehicle that this body passed in mid-June. Following its failure to pass both bodies, a working group was created. Representative Millett was very involved in that working group. I appreciate her efforts and her efforts throughout the process. That working group, to my knowledge, included a number of assistant attorneys general, and I believe Senator Coghill and the other body, Representative Millett, and more recently my office and Ms. Weisler. That is sort of the history of where we are. So with that, I'll read my statement, and then I'll make a couple other comments. Police officers and firefighters are unique in that their job descriptions require that they run to danger and put their lives at risk to save ours. And I'll interrupt myself and let you know that this bill is about looking after people who are truly in what we call the line of duty. Tragically, this sometimes results in their death. Most recently, Alan Brandt became Alaska's 49th police officer to be murdered in the line of duty. In 2014, Alaska troopers Scott Johnson and Gabe Rich were shot and killed in the line of duty in Tanana. Just months ago, Arn Saleo, an Anchorage police officer, was shot five times. He survived, and his survival, of course, is nothing short of a miracle. I also think about the recent spate of police officers killed in the line of duty in the lower 48. Included in that group are a young woman and man near retirement age in Palm Springs, the infamous and tragic death of five police officers in Dallas, and the killing of officers in Baton Rouge. In 2015, 123 police officers were killed in the line of duty in the United States. These officers are part of a brotherhood sisterhood with our own fallen heroes here in Alaska. They are all deserving of our respect and gratitude. But respect and gratitude won't help the families who are left to cope, not just with the loss of their loved one, but also with the loss of health and security. As part of our social compact, we owe more to the police officers and firefighters who risk facing danger just by going to work. At the least, we owe them the assurance that their families will be cared for if the worst happens. Currently, we rely on patchwork solutions with the state and municipalities covering survivors' health premiums on an ad hoc basis. And it truly is an ad hoc basis. For example, I'm told that the Fairbanks City Council is covering Officer Brandt's family's medical needs. What we need, however, is a real fix that is predictable and long-lasting and reflecting a genuine policy of care. That is the aim of the proposed committee substitute to House Bill 23. The bill will ensure that surviving dependents' health insurance premiums are paid by either the state or by municipal employees or employers, importantly employers, or a combination of both. The original version of House Bill 23 would have covered some survivors through the state retirement system known as PERS. The proposed substitute was developed based on a concept developed by an administration working group, the group I just described, that met during the interim and that recently worked with my staff. Under the PERS approach, survivors were offered coverage more suited to an older generation of recipients. That shouldn't be any real surprise. The substitute will continue the survivor's health care coverage at the same level that applied at the officer or the firefighter's death, coverage more suited to young families. Though the final decisions belong to this committee and the legislature as a whole, I made certain choices for the committee substitute before you, which you've adopted, with objection, I'm sure. One decision was whether to require municipalities to cover local police officers and firefighters, and I'll talk to you a little bit about that decision. In my view, the decision was relatively simple. Anchorage has more police officers, I think, and is about to, certainly, we're about to amp up the force, than there are state troopers, and I want to know that their families and families in other communities will have the same benefits as state employees. In addition, under the PERS proposal, and this gets a little tricky, but under the PERS proposal, that is the original proposal that was before the legislature last year, 47 municipalities who participate in PERS would have covered their employees' survivors' health insurance or would have contributed to that coverage. If we simply decided not to use PERS, we would drop those employees that the House saw covered by a vote of 34-0 in June. Let me explain what's happening here. The working group And I'm not going to tell you that my, or rather your bill, is exactly what the administration would want. And I think in some elements you'll find that it most certainly is. In some you may find that it isn't quite. They'll tell you. But the working group concluded that the PERS system was not the preferred method. Number one, having reviewed all the minutes from the nine committee meetings I noted, as well as media reports and the like, there was pushback about, quote, opening up PERS. So this bill uses, rather than an actuarial method, where everyone is sort of contributing something, or nearly everyone, this bill uses a claims idea, where there would be a trust fund created within the Department of Public Safety, overseen by the Department of Public Administration. So it is not a PERS bill. It just isn't. And what you'll find, however, is that if we simply said, since it's not a PERS bill, and this gets a little complicated, but PERS uses a definition for peace officers and firefighters that covers X people in the statute. So it lists all sorts of jobs under the statute for peace officers and firefighters. But there are police officers, people that are first responders, line of duty folks, that are not in PERS. So the PERS model was not perfect to begin with, because you could have police officers, for example, like in the city of Fairbanks, that are not in PERS. Now, how this ever happened, I couldn't tell you. They have their own retirement system. I'm sure former Mayor Thompson knows all about that in detail. So we've gotten ourselves out of PERS, which was the working group's preferred method. And yet we're covering, and if you're wondering, geez, is this going to expand the bill? Well, the department will tell you, but in some ways the bill will shrink and really target the line of duty. Why do I say that? Because we're using a definition for police officer, not peace officer. And we think that we really hit the value statement the legislature wants to make, which is the first responders, the line of duty folks. Now, I'm getting a little long-winded, but there are arguments. Just last year, there were police officers sitting in their office in the lower 48 who were killed, minding their own business, sitting behind a desk. So that can absolutely happen. They probably would not be covered under this bill. Because smaller municipalities will be more impacted by the requirement to pay survivors' premiums, the proposed substitute provides for the state to cover 50% of the premiums if the worst happens and a community loses one of their own. So what we decided was a policy call. I encourage you to make your own. But we believed that, and after I conferred with the Anchorage police, that we couldn't, even though many police departments, for example, Fairbanks, are doing the right and ethical thing and covering families of deceased police officers, we wanted municipalities to say, this is going to be required. But we understood that many of them have sworn officers, take Kuna, for example, which lost two police officers, that could not easily cover the claims brought by the survivors. So we're asking that this institution, the state of Alaska, help to the tune of 50% of those cities' costs. And just as a further comment, understand that the last fiscal note said that this social compact, this sort of value statement, would cost between $170,000 and $220,000. One might surmise that the municipality's obligations would be somewhat, although I can't say this for sure, but somewhat comparable to that. And in the event of, for example, Representative Foster represents Nome. I know they have their own sworn officers. They have their own police department. They, as I understand it, would pay nothing if good luck holds and they don't lose an officer. So the burden is restricted in that way, too. As I said, this is the 10th hearing on this subject in this body. I can only imagine, and I want you to think about this, the effect on employee morale and the alternative reality if we offer no benefit. Believe me when I tell you that police officers and firefighters are watching what we do here. We hope that we can finally join with 14 other states, blue and red states, I noticed, and get this important matter decided. It is time we gave substance to our appreciation for the invaluable work that first responders in line of duty employees engage in every day. My last comment, reading through the minutes, there was a lot of discussion about PERS, and we think we've dispensed with that, but I can't say how you feel about that. But I did want to say that there was a lot of discussion in the minutes where this body said, what about the fact that the typist one, there is no such thing anymore, as we know, but the clerk one would not receive this coverage. Well, we have a memo from Megan Wallace in mid-June, and she says with some confidence that this is an economic interest, and therefore, based on a rational basis, if the courts say, yep, this is rational, these people are more prone because of the difficulties of going into the field with, you know, loaded assailants in front of them, these people are more prone to suffer the ultimate price. And so I think that Ms. Wallace's memorandum is correct. And I would note that that is correct, that there's no equal protection problem. And I would note that one of the assistant attorneys general said the same thing last June, albeit, in fairness, it was a different bill, but I think the logic would continue. With that, I'll take any questions, and we can do a sectional analysis for you.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. It looks like you hit on most of what's in the sectional analysis. You're welcome if you wanted to go through it in case anything was missed to do that. We do have that before us, and I guess if there are any questions with regard to that, we'll start with Representative Thompson and then Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, I just wanted to clarify that the police and fire in Fairbanks are under this state's system. I mean, they are PERS, and they always have been. I don't know where that information might have came from.
It's buried in my binder from one conversation or another, but we were told that the city of Fairbanks or the borough, one of the two, was not a member of PERS.
Would certainly know. Probably the borough with volunteer fire departments where they have hired police chiefs at the Steve's Volunteer Fire Department and things. That might have been where that came from. But the city is PERS, does cover police and fire. I've got a multiple amount of questions, but one of the emails I just received that came in through the chair was that. And I don't know where they get their numbers, but this is stating that the Alaska Department of Fish and Game lost 27 of their people through airplane crashes, diving problems, you know, different things like that. And according to them, that is more than have been lost by the state troopers at 16. So how do we go about trying to cover them? I mean, this would make sense where they're losing a lot of people at the same time.
Well, through the chair, Representative Thompson, my view is that with a fiscal plan, we could do it. But we don't have a fiscal plan yet, and there is a demarcation where people, quote, run to harm. And that's the demarcation this bill covers. Firefighters, police officers do this hazardous thing. They run to harm. Now, fire, you know, certainly people suppressing fire in a forest do the same thing. But it's a policy call. Do I think that this great state with a fiscal plan could cover 27 lives? Sure. Do I think those lives are worthy? You bet. But the impetus for this, what brought us here originally, was the death of Troopers Johnson and Rich. And the consensus from both bodies, and I know we're supposed to focus on our body, is line of duty. And that's where the demarcation was drawn. But I take your point.
And if I could just, I just want to let, as we go forward with the questions here, let folks know that we do have other people available to answer questions. We do have from the Department of Law, Joan Wilkerson. We have from the Department of Administration, Michelle McLeod, Chief Health Official. From the Department of Public Safety, we have Commissioner Walt Monaghan, Deputy Commissioner Bill Comer, Kelly Howell, Department of Public Safety Administrative Services Director. And then finally, we also have Allison Hanzawa, Special Assistant Legislative Liaison. So we do have some other folks that are available, but please proceed with your questions.
I'll try to be brief and just hold it to a couple of questions, but through the chair, Representative, I don't know how to quite state this one. It's a two-part question, basically. How many municipalities do we have in the state that are under 10,000 population? And along with that, a municipality is an organized community that is chartered. For example, the city of Delta Junction has a fire department. They are not a municipality, but they do have firefighters that are paid. And I'm curious, where does the line draw on these type of situations?
Through the chair, very good question. I think you may find, and you may want to entertain an amendment proposed from the Department of Law that would better clarify that this bill is meant to cover full-time sworn officers and firefighters, and a definition is on page 4 for firefighters. It means an employee of the state or municipality employed to perform fire suppression services. That is a definition that was recommended to us. But I take your point that there are those sorts of ambiguities, and I'm welcome to trying to solve them. In answer to your other question, I believe we're going to find, we can find the answer. I don't have it. We knew that it might be asked, but we need to find the answer to how many communities are under 10,000 that are organized. I think you're going to find that because there are about 50 that are in the PERS system, there are going to be, I think I remember the number, 157 total.
I don't know.
You're going to find there are many who have a police force but are not in the PERS system. And so, again, this is designed to offer some state aid for that. We think it's going to be a very modest cost based on the previous fiscal note.
I'll just ask one final, and you can move on through the chair. I didn't quite understand in the bill, is the municipality liable for retroactivity of somebody that from the past, does this bill put it into effect that they would have to go back and pick up some costs there or not? I didn't quite understand that.
I think the answer is no. This is a prospective bill because, fortunately, either our state government or local governments have. Now, I can't speak for every situation. So, for example, in 2013, Trooper Toll died, I think, in a helicopter crash. I don't really know what happened there. But I think, generally, the governments have done the honorable thing, but it would be better to have a system.
Thank you.
Representative.
I'll have more later.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. We've got a question from Representative Gutenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Josephson, I am a little troubled by the process of buying them insurance instead of fulfilling the PERS obligation to get them to the end of the day. And, you know, because I've been dwelling on this for months, as just as everybody else has, actually quite a bit longer than that. But did you consider setting up a fund? Because, you know, as heartbreaking as the situation is for the family and the state, at the end of the day, there's actuarial work here that answers and fills in most of the forms. But every municipality that has, and every entity that has people in PERS pays in a calculated amount, and every employee, regardless of job classification, killed in the line of duty would be covered. That's just an actuarial calculation. And from that fund, you would simply pay their PERS, and you're not opening up PERS, you're just continuing to make a contribution. And Officer Johnson, he was well past 20 years, just waiting for 25, and just fulfilling that obligation to the point when he would have normally retired. We know when that was. But not everybody charging into the line of fire is a police officer or a fireman. If you are at an airport and there's an accident, the dozer operator or the CAT operator, the guy running the backhoe, is charging in with his piece of equipment. And there's many other opportunities, and lots of people are wondering where you draw the line. Now, maybe it's a political dialogue of where you start, and you have to start someplace, but it seems like if we have an opportunity to include everybody in the line of duty, we're just setting up a separate fund that every entity in the system pays an actuarial calculated cost to cover, you know, X number of employees that are going to lose their life in the line of duty to fulfill that rest of their PERS obligation, that would cover that. Has that been part of the dialogue or discussed?
Well, it was, and what I'm trying to find now is the response in the minutes. If you give me one moment. Essentially, I don't know that there's a system to collect essentially a per share for someone who's no longer an employee because they're deceased. But I'm going to defer to Ms. Weisler on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Lisa
Weisler. Lower the microphone, bring the microphone down.
Short. Okay. For the record, this is Lisa Weisler, Chief of Staff to Representative Josephson. In terms of the discussion that happened in building this committee substitute, there was a lot of discussion. This is creating a fund, and the discussion was whether to fill that fund sort of ahead of time through an actuarial analysis, so everybody would have to throw in the money, or do it how it is presented in version O, which is needs-based. And part of the thinking for going with the needs-based was that then we are not tying up communities' funds in, you know, that would just sit there. And that hopefully, you know, the amount that's needed is small, because you know, we can hope that these awful things don't happen. And so the decision was to make it needs-based. When you talk about the PERS system, there are other problems with it. One, it wouldn't cover, you know, any of these communities that don't participate in PERS. And there were other problems, too. For example, the spouse has to be, for a dependent to be covered, there has to be a surviving spouse. It would not have covered a single employee who died in the line of duty who had a child. And so the fund was developed to be a little more flexible and to cover a lot of these other situations. So there was discussion of this and a decision made to go with a needs-based approach.
Thank you, Mr. Jeremy. We're writing policy here, and we can make those decisions as well. Thank you.
Do we have any other questions? We've got a question from Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Pruitt. Thank you, Representative Josephson, for bringing this forward once again. I appreciate your work on it for the last couple years. Had a couple questions because they had been brought up in the House Finance Committee at an earlier time about the ability for village public safety officers to be sort of covered at the same level, and your thoughts on that.
Yes, and I saw, through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I saw your interest in that. I share your interest from late on the day on June 18th, 2016. So, you know, I was very disturbed by what happened to Officer Madol in Manicotic several years ago. I attended a hearing where his widow testified. It was very, very sad and distressing. It's part of the reason I backed Speaker Edgeman's bill to arm VPSOs. There was discussion, I think, in the working group, and certainly in my office, about adding VPSOs. They are, now I think there are exceptions to the exception. The exception, let's start with the exception. The exception is that they are funded through nonprofit regional corporations. They are, of course, linked to DPS. They go through training in Sitka, that sort of thing. I said there's an exception to the exception. I think that there are some VPSOs who may be employees, for example, of the NANA region. And I think that appears in the minutes at one point. But fundamentally, we think that their work is critical and that they need their day before this body. But this bill does not cover them.
Okay. Thank you. And then another question, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
Yeah, just a separate question on the definitional parts about small municipality versus the others, because the payout's different for a small municipality. Was that is that number set because of, I guess, why is that number set at 10,000? Is there a mathematical reason for having it set at that level? Is it just because of the ability for a small municipality to be able to pay into the system?
Well, I want to have Ms. Weisler speak to that, but I will tell you that I was, you know, whenever we have meetings or conversations, there are some that stick with us, and one of mine with an APD officer last week really did, and Officer Wilson expressed a concern that APD Officer Wilson, that small communities might find it prohibitively expensive to have to, quote, pony up, that wasn't, those are my words, the entire expense. But I'll ask Ms. Weisler to speak.
And if I could, I just want to recognize that we have in the audience with us Representative Kopp. Please proceed.
Through the chair, Lisa Weisler. That 10,000 came through a discussion with AML, and it was just what seemed reasonable. And I think that there, I think it would take more discussion perhaps with AML, but thinking about the communities and their financial capabilities, that seemed like a reasonable number. There's, I think, around 8 communities that are above 10,000.
And one more question, just a brief one. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pretty much every iteration of the bill had a retroactivity clause, and it was specifically because of the, you know, the, just the people had Trooper Johnson and Trooper Rich in mind. Of course, now we have Sergeant Alan Brandt from Fairbanks. This bill doesn't have a retroactive clause, but it has an immediate effective date. But it's the way I read it, and I'll have to ask you, it's still, we would be open, is it open to any previous officer who or officer's family? And how many is that, if that's a thing?
I'm going to let, I think I know the answer, but I'm going to ask Ms. Weisler to help me.
Thank you. to the chair, Lisa Weisler. The effective date did come from the administration, and so it might be good for them to answer. What I believe is that the families that are currently in this situation are being covered, and so they would be able to, once this bill passes, they would be able to apply for continuing coverage from either the state or municipality.
But follow-up, but it looks like the way it reads, it's that if anybody, even previous to that date, they would also become eligible if they fit the criteria as laid out by the Commissioner of Public Safety.
Thank you, through the chair. And again, I think I'm going to call a lifeline with the administration. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Is that something that you wanted the administration right now? Anyone online or?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, if there's someone in the audience that could answer.
We have a lifeline out there. Maybe it's something that we can come back to and get the information to the committee and then disseminate out. We do have somebody. If you could,
I think Ms. Wilkerson is here.
Okay. You could state your name for the record and proceed.
For the record, my name is Joan Wilkerson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. Through the chair, the answer to the question is, thank you, and how the bill is built. And if we turn to page 4.
Of the
CS in front of us, yes. And we look at to section 5, we see that the act would take effect on July 1st, 2017. So as anticipated, a person needing these benefits could apply, and if they establish eligibility, could be considered for coverage. And one of the mandates that are necessary for establishing eligibility is whether they have access to medical insurance already. So if a person is already has medical insurance through perhaps retirement benefits, then and they don't need additional insurance, then they wouldn't be eligible. But it's designed for, it deliberately doesn't have a retroactive impact, but it is designed for, to there is no date that would cut somebody off, as it were. So.
Thank you. We've got a question from Representative Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So last year, of course, this was in front of us, and there was there were some people had concerns about the actual makeup of the bill, and we were getting into a situation where politics was pushing what potentially where was some policy that might have some people had concern with. I know it, at that point in time, the minority had been working on it for about 6 years. What I'd like to say is I appreciate the work that went over the interim by the minority leader, by the administration, by yourself, because what we have in front of us, I think, is a much better piece of policy. We're going to be able to do what we all wanted to do, but now without that initial political and end-of-session pressure, I think we took that time appropriately over the interim to come up with something that I think delivers what we want to in a manner that doesn't have all other consequences. So that's to commend the work that was done. My question comes, and this truly is a policy question. It might sound initially like it's trying to get you to get into something. I really want to understand the thought process and the policy here, and that is the intent of the bill and the intent of the legislation that we will provide for the life of that individual or the family after they have had their family member pass, or is the intent to be a transition and a bridge from having that person in their life to whatever is to come in the future? What kind of is our goal? What are we trying to accomplish?
Well, I guess it's best for me to answer that. So originally, Governor Parnell, of course, had a one-year administrative solution. My bill, House Bill 3, was very modest and had a one-year solution. I believe Representative Millett's was time-limited by sort of young adulthood. I'm going to say it probably was 23 or 26 for the children. It was Medicare eligibility for the spouse, I don't have it in front of me, but I suspect it may very well have said in the event there's other insurance available, something along those lines. This body, I think, that is the Finance Committee, accepted a 10-year limit. My bill or your bill, this committee substitute, doesn't have that. So we go back to saying we're going to cover widows and widowers until they are eligible for Medicare, essentially, or as Ms. I just said her name, Wilkerson. I almost said Dickerson, but it's Wilkerson. As Ms. Wilkerson said, until there's other coverage, in which case they would no longer be eligible. And then we've chosen 26 because of the Affordable Care Act. I'm aware that that act may meet its demise, but nonetheless, we've used that year because that's the federal law, and it seemed to make for a seamless sort of coverage.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
And if I could I add one more thing? And
Representative Josephson?
Representative Guerra noted in the minutes that you have the obvious problem where if you had an unborn child or a one-year-old, they would lose coverage at 11. And so the 10-year limit has problems.
Follow up. Thank you. I appreciate that. And that was a very valid point that we discussed last year was an unborn child and the impact on that unborn child. I did see the 26. I think most people probably could argue that that makes sense. That is the current time frame for a young adult, for a child that is with their parents. That one makes sense. There is a time frame where we have allowed the transition to take place, and in that case, move on into adulthood, move on to that next stage. The 65, of course, gives a little bit more time frame. Is that, and of course, this moves into then the financial aspect of this, not just for the state, but for some of the small communities. And actually, that would be my next question: is the municipal participation? Are a discussion in terms of with the spouse a transition time frame, whether it's a 10-year or something like that? Is that something that you'd be amenable to talking about to allow for that, and I don't know the time frame. I'm not sitting here trying to set a time frame, but a transition time frame so that as they move on with their life and move forward, that basically policy catches up with them.
I through the chair, if the question is would I support such a bill on the floor, for example, and the answer is very likely. I think that the social compact that I talk about is there for me, and so I think there's an argument that it should be longer. I would note that I think it was Trooper Johnson's wife who spoke eloquently, and I think Trooper Toll's wife, about the trauma of losing their best friends. That's the words they use. And learning that at the 30th or 31st day of the month where the officer fell, they lost their insurance. And, there was discussion of, well, can they get life insurance? Well, yes, except that's life insurance. That's for their life. It's really, I understand it's for the deceased life, but it's really not, this is a special privilege that we think should be afforded to the families, because their often husbands paid the ultimate price, and that they shouldn't need to, maybe they received a $100,000 policy, but maybe there's four children at home and they're 2, 4, 6, and 8. That isn't going to do much. It's nice, but that was part of the thinking there too.
And I don't think there's a discussion about the 30 days. I think we've kind of there's an understanding. I mean, I supported the bill as it hit the floor, even though I think this is better policy, and we're there. That it's not about providing. It's really a discussion about the state's responsibility, and at what point do we feel that the state's responsibility ends, whether it's 65, whether it's 10 years, whatever. And that we can discuss that more. I do want to ask, though, the municipal contribution portion of it. If I read this right, we will be requiring in this situation a municipal contribution from, for Anchorage, it would be the full 100%. For a smaller community, it would be 50%. If I understood correctly, that making that mandatory could have some challenges. Are you aware of that, and how should we rectify that if that is potentially a problem?
All I can tell you, a couple things. It won't surprise you, through the chair, Representative Pruitt, that the AML did not, although I know they care about their fallen officers too, but they weren't sort of grasping at this and celebrating necessarily. But I think they want to do the right thing. I can't speak for them. But in answer to your question, and tell me one more time, and it'll come back to me immediately, I promise.
If I understood correctly in discussions that I've had, that making it mandatory, potentially,
yes,
we might not actually be
right.
Able to do that.
Well, so all I can tell you is that the Department of Law reports to me that they are investigating that very question, and they indicated that this morning. That's all I know.
Okay, so we don't, Mr. Chair,
hello?
And sorry. So we don't have, that may be something that we're going to have to come back on. We're not sure yet, and maybe by next week
Unless Ms. Wilkerson has something else to report, that's my understanding.
Okay.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair.
Ms. Wilkerson, I just wanted to remind you, put your name for the record.
Yes, Joan Wilkerson from Department of Law. Representative Pruitt, through the chair, we received this version of the bill kind of late in the day, and we regret that we were unable to give it the full vetting that we would like to give it to answer your question, but we intend to have those answers for you as soon as possible. So I don't want to give you a partial answer. I would rather get the full answer from the – I specialize in retirement and benefits. That's what I do. But the Assistant Attorney General, who specializes in municipal law, is working on it right now. So we intend to get you those answers.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, to you on this last point, and I should also assume that the fiscal notes here are applied to the old CS. They do not apply to the current bill that's in front of us. Is that a correct assumption?
That looks correct to me, but unless there's somebody who can correct me with that, that would be correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do we have any further questions of the committee? We've got a Representative Seaton, co-chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to understand the full parameters. On page 3, line 3, starting there, I was trying to find in the line of duty has been used a number of times and trying to decide, I guess it's on starting in line 4, while in the performance and within the scope of the employee's duty. Does that include people that are on call 24 hours a day?
On call 24 hours. Through the chair, you are the chair. It seems like it would, but I'm not sure what you mean.
Follow.
I'm trying to find the scope. I mean, we've talked about in the line of duty, like running into fire, you know, a police officer in an investigation, those kind of things. And I'm trying to find out whether the wording as it is here means that it covers a person if they're on call 24 hours a day, as they are in some communities. I'm not expressing an opinion on that. I'm just trying to find out what the scope of the language, what that entails.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I were an attorney, I sort of am, but if I were going to defend someone, if I were going to defend someone who was denied a benefit, I would not probably before a judge say the words line of duty. I might, just because it's sort of lay words, but I would have to focus on this paragraph, the very one you discussed. I'd have to exclude paragraph 4 and say my client, my late client was not willfully negligent. But you're right that it's all about subparagraph 3, line 3, page 3.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm just putting this out so that you can address it and get back to us at the next meeting on what the exact parameters of this is and is coverage within that. And another question?
Follow-up? Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And I'm trying to figure out on the same page 3 there, starting on basically line 10, becomes eligible to receive major medical insurance coverage benefits by another means. Mm-hmm. So becomes eligible to receive, does that mean if a spouse would remarry and through their spouse they could get insurance and covered? Would that be then deemed as becoming eligible to receive major medical benefits, or is that you have actually contracted for and decided to get major medical benefits?
Well, Mr. Chairman, my answer would be the former. You do have 3 lawyers before you, so we could compete, but I think it would read, and it'd be interesting to hear what my colleagues say, but I think it would mean the former, that if you're eligible, then you would no longer qualify. That is, if you married someone who had insurance and it was provided for you, And I suppose you could quibble about whether it was fully provided for you or whether there had to be some copay or premium. In fact, you really probably could quibble because this benefit is full under the bill. But I think that one might conclude that that person was no longer eligible, that they had to pick up their spouse's policy. It's just my opinion. I don't know.
Follow up?
And a follow-up on that. So I guess I'm trying to figure out if a let's just presume for this that it's the husband that is shot or dies. If the spouse, if the mother does not have, and they have minor kids, does not have a fairly substantial income on her own, and so she becomes eligible for Denali Kid Care as the parent of a minor child. Does that mean that the eligibility for Medicaid under Denali Kid Care, which the state provides, would be the prime eligibility, and then this wouldn't apply in that case?
I have my own opinion about my preference of that, but I'm going to defer, if I may, to see what my colleagues think.
And again, Mr. Chairman,
follow up.
I just want to make it clear that I'm putting these out so that the answers can be developed and get back to us. I'm not trying to put anybody on the spot. I'm just reading the bill. We just received it tonight. Thank you.
John Wilkerson, Representative Seaton, through the chair. The answer would be that as we read through on page 3, the dependent child would be eligible for alternative insurance and therefore would be capable of getting the other insurance. The spouse, however, would not be covered by the Denali Kid Care, and they would still be eligible for insurance.
Hello?
Cover general.
Doesn't Denali Kid Care cover the parents of eligible children as well?
I'm sorry, I'm just, apparently I'm not adequately familiar with that form of coverage. I thought it was only for children.
Well,
stand corrected if I'm wrong.
Follow up on that, find out. And one other thing.
Representative Seaton and then Representative Ortiz.
And that ends on page 3, line 12 there, where you have age 65, and the statement was about Medicaid or Medicare eligible. Should that be rewritten as Medicare eligible age, because depending upon when the person was born, Medicare eligibility is progressing so that it could be 67 or a different age there. I just wanted to note that
okay.
You might want to investigate that.
Sure. Thank you. That's a good point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We've got Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your discussions over the summer and previous discussions about this issue, I'm sure you guys probably looked at the idea of prorating that smaller community number even further. Let's say you go to 5,000 and you're at 25%. You looked at that, and that's probably just too problematic to start talking about those kinds of things.
Through the chair, we did, but I'm going to defer to Ms. Weisler because she was more directly looking at that issue, but she and I certainly conversed about it. Ms. Weisler?
Mr. Chairman, Lisa Weisler, Chief of Staff, Representative Josephson's office. This solution actually came up quite recently. We were struggling with this notion of covering or requiring municipalities to cover their employees, recognizing the problems for small communities, and so this was the idea to try to mitigate the impact. It could be that there could be three tiers and set it up that way. So that's more of a policy decision. This was just one way to try to again, mitigate the impacts.
Thank you.
Have any further questions of the committee? Okay. Well, seeing no questions, I'll be putting HB 23 aside. We'll be taking this back up on Wednesday, February 1. At that time, we'll be taking up public testimony, and we'll also be looking to have amendments in by Friday on February 3. Was there a question? No questions. Okay. With that, we do have a finance committee scheduled for tomorrow, Friday, January 27 at 1:30 p.m. At that meeting, we'll be hearing the overviews on FY18 budgets by the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, Department of Environmental Conservation, and the Department of Administration. And with that, we will go ahead and gavel out. The time now is 6:26 p.m. Thank you, everybody.